Tonight on Arena, The Book of Clarence, The Sweet East, Abigail and All You Need Is Death are the movies up for review, and Emma Jordan on her new production of Martin McDonagh's The Pillow Man at Belfast's Lyric Theatre. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Tonight's film reviews, we have A Child Vampire, A Haunted Sean Nose, and A Parallel Life of Christ, kind of. All four films, in fact, that we have varying degrees of Irish interest, starting with Abigail, in which Dubliner Alicia Weir plays the most terrifying pint-sized undead since Kirsten Dunst in Interview with a Vampire. In Irish folk horror fable, All You Need Is Death, complex questions of preservation and trust collide. Is he the Messiah or just a very naughty boy? Couldn't resist it. The Book of Clarence tells us the story of an opportunistic contemporary alternative to the Christ story. And Talia Ryder stars as Lillian in The Sweet East, starry-eyed American picaresque for our time. Jacob Elordi and Ayo Edebiri co-star. Tara Brady, Hilary White have been to the movies and they're with me in studio this evening. And we'll start with Abigail, which stars Matilda,
I suppose. It does.
Which is where we know Alicia Weir. But in this case, she is a ballet dancing bloodsucker who turns the tables on her would-be captors. And this is actually a remake of a classic horror, Tara.
Well, yes and no.
A rethink, it's kind of.
So, as you know, for more than a decade, Universal have tried to reboot all of their... Like in the 1930s, Universal's main product were the monster movies. So it was Bride of Frankenstein and Hunchback, all these kind of films. And they had those great big gothic performances, and they made stars like Boris Karloff. So they've had a whole bunch of goes at this. Most recently, they had a reboot of The Mummy with Tom Cruise, and that was a disaster. So this dark universe that they've been trying for a while just hasn't really worked out. But then just before COVID, they had a kind of random hit with The Invisible Man, and that did really well. And unlike the other ones, which were all made for $200 million, it was made on quite a small budget. So this is the same kind of idea. It's a kind of smaller budget as opposed to a more grandiose one, and it's, as you say, it's a ballerina vampire movie with an awful lot of dancing and an awful lot of like spinning cameras. So the setup is this: it's one of these ludicrous like kidnap plots where there's far too many people coming in to kidnap. It's like, what do they need all these people for? Of course they're going to get caught. It's like a parade of people coming in to
Dan Stevens is in there
to kidnap a small girl, to kidnap this, you know, pint-sized little girl, and you know, and then suddenly they grab her, they go off to this really absurdly gothic mansion, which should be their first clue that something is very, very amiss. And but they don't twig this at all, and then they discover they're trapped in the house with this vampire who keeps dancing at them and ripping their heads off.
Yeah, and of course they're going to go. They're hardly going to go to a suburban house that looks gorgeous with nice bright colours. Of course they're going to go to a gothic mansion. Where else can you have a horror film? But Dan Stevens is one of the kidnappers. Melissa Barrera is one of the kidnappers too. And there are others in there in this motley gang. They're looking for money, effectively, Hilary.
So basically our little ballerina vampiress is, before they know that she's a vampiress, she is the daughter of a very rich person, and they've been told by a shady client through an interloper played by Giancarlo Esposito, that there'll be 50 million if they hold her for ransom. And what happens then is, as Tara says, they get locked in this mansion. And while all the bickering happens while we're locked in, they discover that the girl is the daughter of this very mysterious Kaiser Soze-like crime kingpin.
Okay. Let us listen to a clip which features Alicia Weir as Abigail speaking to one of the kidnappers, Joey, played by Melissa Barrera. Be careful who you kidnap.
My dad, well, like, he thought he wanted a child, but then he just lost interest. You've made a mistake. He doesn't care about me.
I'm gonna leave you alone now. I'll be back soon.
Really soon, okay?
Okay.
Joey?
Yeah.
I'm sorry about what's gonna happen to you.
Oh.
I don't think it's that you're going to get a slightly off sandwich. That's not what's going to happen to her here. That's Abigail, played by Alicia Weir, and Joey, who's something off is going to happen to, played by Melissa Barrera. I guess that's what a horror film does for us, though, essentially, Tara, isn't it? It builds up this tension, mm-hmm. and it kind of has this lovely innocence alongside this malevolence.
No, it's definitely a good idea. And if you're into the Grand Guignol, there's plenty of it. I mean, there's like geysers of blood in this film. There's just so much red, and there's a really great over the top performance by Dan Stevens, and you know, obviously Melissa Barrera is a kind of absolute veteran final girl in horror movies. So you're in safe hands in this way. But the problem is that like the actual horror movie still needs some kind of internal logic, yeah. and the film doesn't really know what it's doing. You get these kind of like, oh, let's team up, you and I, and then the alliance falls apart in the next scene. There are all these like, you're trying to work out the geography of the house. There are all these like, look at this corridor and here's another corridor, and there's so many back corridors. I don't know where there was going. And also I think, like, you know, when you're doing that kind of Agatha Christie, you know, and then there were none, you know, there just needs to be a little bit more tension as opposed to head ripped off.
Yeah.
Mm. Don't go for the head rip off straight away.
So they're giving everything away.
Yeah.
So what you want is that tension to build. And it has to unravel at some point. But is the problem here?
Well, the unravelling is the name of the game with all horror films. Yeah. But the problem with this is that the unravelling is just this sort of explosion of corn syrup and gore. And any of the kind of the seductive qualities of the vampire myth are not there. It's not funny enough where it should be a bit more camp. It starts to get very sort of serious, self-serious in parts, where it should be kind of a bit lighter. And I just didn't think the payoff was good enough at the end of the whole thing.
Standout performances as you give us your stars, Henry?
Oh, well, absolutely. Our young star, Alicia Weir, who is destined for great things. Like, she puts her back into this in a big way. And she is the best thing about it.
And stars?
I will go 2.5.
2.5. What are you saying overall? Alicia stands out for you.
Thumbs up for Alicia. 2 stars for the movie.
All right. Well, let us give the big thumbs up to Alicia Weir. And wonderful that you both seem to think that she's the best thing. The best
Definitely.
Thing in it.
Yeah.
Let us move on then to the perils of coveting and ultimately taking that which does not belong to you. This is very much part of Paul Dwan's very Irish folk horror tale, All You Need Is Hate. The film stars Alwyn Ferry as a torchbearer of sorts for an ancient song of heartbreak and lost. But when collectors record this ancient tune surreptitiously, all manner of hell breaks loose. Ian Lynch of Lancome was in with me earlier in the week talking about how in real life people don't like when you do surreptitious recording of songs that they're singing. However, it never goes to quite the distance that this one goes to in terms of revenge. Mm-hmm. Again, we're in a good setup here, it has to be said, Hilary, to start out.
Yeah, very interesting. So in a very sort of intriguing, overripe intro, we meet Anna, played by Simone Collins, and her partner Alex, who Charlie Maher, with a very kind of stage Russian accent. And they are scouring old Irish pubs for folk songs, for trad songs, which they secretly record. And the two of them are kind of operators, and there's a lot of sort of, you know, confidence conmanship going on. And the idea then is that they take these recordings off and they either sell them on the black market to, you know, shady millionaire collectors, or they bring them to this sort of clandestine song harvesting association chaired by Catherine Siggins's sort of, you know, guide or mentor, if you like. Yeah.
And then enter the fray, Alwyn Ferry as Rita Concannon, and my favourite name for a character this year so far, Breeze Block.
Yes, Breeze Block. Yes, no, that's by Nigel O'Neill. I mean, this is where the movie gets like really great, because Breeze Block is also a puppeteer, which leaves like space for lots of creepy puppets lurking around in the background, which is one of the many kind of great textures about the film. But you know, we're talking about people making stupid decisions in Abigail, but you know, it has to be one of the, you know, and horror movie thrives on stupid decisions. Yeah. You have to go go down into the spooky basement on, you know, without turning on the lights and all that kind of thing. But, you know, when Alban Fair like warns you that you can't record this song or take it away in any way,
whatever you do,
you know, in her witchiest voice, and they go ahead and do it, you just go, what? Now, this is the all time bad call of all. So this is unbelievable, even by horror movies.
Again, though, I kind of thought, well, that's what they're there to do. Of course, they're going to do it. Let's have a listen to Alban Fuere as Rita explaining the power of this particular song.
I know the song you want. My mother learnt it from her mother. And so on and so forth. Back to the old times. It's not even in Irish. But whatever it is that came before Irish. There was a king once who loved a poor woman who betrayed him. And the punishment he put on her and her lover and their baby was terrible. The love curdled inside them and became a curse, what you might call an evil spirit on the world. My mother told me that it comes from a time before writing down, when memory was the way we had to hold things, and that the song should never be written down or anything like that, but to be remembered and sung by our women. No matter that we don't understand it, we just have to keep the line from breaking.
Alban Fuere there in the scene from All You Need Is Death. And Hilary, it does bring up an interesting, that particular clip brings up an interesting theme that is running here, which is the idea of actually taking something that doesn't belong to you and that kind of, I suppose, cultural appropriation. What's the...
Appropriation.
Thank you very much. Cultural appropriation.
Yeah, sure. And I suppose it also taps into, you know, a very recent resurgence of interest in our old folk music as well, and appreciation for these things. And you notice that Ian Lynch, who you mentioned, does the soundtrack for
it. In fact, Paul Dwan said if it wasn't for Lancome's music, if Ian Lynch didn't like the script, he wasn't even going to do the movie.
Yeah, and we see their effect kind of transcending genre as well. I mean, you know, Shea Gleason's new novel, like, she nods to Lancome as well in that. And, you know, that's a very interesting part of it. And certainly in Lancome's music, there is that kind of that dread and that ancient kind of moodiness in it. I think maybe the problem with this is that, you know, a very interesting premise like that starts to become a bit less defined as the film goes on and we're into the unravelling and the reveal of this great evil that's awoken with the song. And I thought some very interesting work that's done in the premise and the build-up to it it slightly escapes the whole thing, just in this very strange kind of sag in the middle of the film, where I thought it lost a lot of energy. And then when they tried to make things a bit more fruity and a bit more dark and, you know, terrific towards the end, I just didn't think I was on board with the evil any longer.
Well, we also have to say that this was made on two and fourpence.
Yeah, and I think that is maybe part of the problem where it's goes a little bit awry at the end. It's like there's a lot of budgetary constraints there, and what they've done in terms of production design, in terms of even like the mood. I think definitely for the first half of the film, it feels like you're like in Eternal Night that you're just never going to get,
and very dark,
which is like it's incredibly gloomy and oppressive. And disconcerting to watch. And I thought, like, I mean, the actual story in the song, which I won't spoil, it's out there. Yeah. Well done. I mean, that's
and the singing, Alban Fuere sings the song, and I played that with Ian Lynch on Monday night. It's kind of incredible.
Well, it's a cliche to say when, like, the landscape or music or something is its character in its own right, but by golly, it is. It really is. It's such a huge, like, impactful thing. And, like, worst of all, it stays in your head afterwards, long after the film, which is very, very creepy indeed.
Yeah, and the soundtrack is out there now on digital, and it'll be released, I believe, on a green vinyl, splattered with black later, I think, at the beginning of May, some at some point along the way. Overall, did this work on stars from you, Tara?
I think obviously the first half is stronger, but I mean, it's just so brilliantly imaginative. I'd go 3.5, even though it gets a little bit screwy towards the end.
And you, Hilary?
I think Paul Dewan has earned the right to be a bit self-indulgent. He is a stalwart, and I think this is a very interesting premise, this film. Mm. I just don't think it works overall as a thing. So it is 3 from me.
3 from you. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on then to The Book of Clarence. James C. Samuel's The Book of Clarence. A cynical anti-hero jumps on the Christianity bandwagon in the hope of personal aggrandizement. Lakeith Stanfield stars as the eponymous Clarence, down on his luck contemporary of Christ, who sees the opportunity where others see divinity. The film boasts impressive supporting cast: David Oyelowo, James McAvoy, Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Vaughan Lawler. This is an A-list cast.
No. This is a proper biblical epic. Like, not only just in the cast, but you know, from the opening scene, and you get this huge like chariot race, and it's like, oh my god, this is
we're in Ben-Hur.
We're in Ben-Hur. Yeah. This is fantastic. It's such a really interesting thing. It's impossible to talk about it without talking about the life of Brian.
Of course,
you have to talk about the Life of Brian is about someone who really doesn't want to be mistaken for the Messiah, and this is about someone who deliberately sets out to be mistaken for the Messiah. And it's a brilliant kind of dual performance from Lakeith Stanfield, who's like just such a terrific actor anyway, but he's playing Thomas, who's the real disciple of Jesus, you know, and you know, very much in earnest on board with the program, you know, and then his kind of loser twin brother Clarence.
So he plays the two characters.
So Clarence is really, you know, he's kind of a hustler, and he's out to So initially he thinks, oh, I'm going to fall. These Christians are up and coming. So I'm going to, and he owes money from the chariot race to Mary Magdalene, who's also in the opening scene. So he thinks, right, I'll latch on to these Christians and I might be able to squeeze some money out of it. But, you know, what happens is John the Baptist immediately spots him as a fraud, and he has to go off and think, right, well, I'm going to fashion myself as some kind of Jesus.
Okay, yeah. So it's Doubting Thomas and Hustling Clarence is basically what we have here, the two disciples. So here is Lakeith Stanfield as the hustler, as Clarence, visiting John the Baptist, played by David Oyelowo, who sees through him immediately.
Okay, if God exists, truly.
Dear Lord, save this sinner from himself. Clarence is dumb and stupid, always selling his illegalities when he could just as easily have a regular occupation. And now he's in trouble with the village terror, and he's also in love with said terror's little sister, who he is not in the slightest bit worthy of, I might add. Dear Lord, he is definitely going to get killed by Jedediah the Terrible. So when you finally meet him, Lord, which is soon, please, let him inside heaven, Lord, and then kick him out! So that she shall forever know what he is missing, because he did not know the depth of his own idiocy to not repent.
Amen?
Amen.
Say it.
Amen.
And there you go. Oh, David Oyelowo and who is the person?
Lakeith Stanfield.
Yeah, thank you, Lakeith Stanfield as Clarence there in a scene from The Book of Clarence. Listening to that, Hilary, I wonder to what extent there's a kind of a sincere air at one level about it, or is it a pastiche of, you know, the big biblical epics? I'm expecting Charlton Heston to appear at any moment.
Sure, yeah. I think I said in my review, it was like a sort of a stoner take on The Last Temptation of Christ or something. But it definitely is. I think it's what I really loved about this film. Lakeith Stanfield he's a wonderful actor. And every time I look at him, he's like a sort of a slacker kind of layabout who I'm kind of going to root for no matter what happens. And I loved, you know, James Samuel, who directs this. He brings this lovely kind of sort of cartoonish quality to the whole thing, where it is quite silly and it is quite cartoonish, as I say, but there's lots to root for in the character. And you see the character actually develops this, you know, an aspiration to transcend himself and to be better in the eyes of the woman he loves, his mother, society and everything. And it makes you smile in an unusual way, this film, I thought.
Yeah. And what was the tone for you here? Because it doesn't quite go down the ridiculous quality of The Life of Brian, even though The Life of Brian is the first film that springs to mind when you hear about this.
It's a slightly muddled tone in some ways, and for a lot of the time it works. I mean, because it has all this kind of anachronistic music, like Doja Cat and Jay-Z, who's also a producer on the film.
Yeah, because what we heard there is very much the biblical epic type of score, but there's loads of contemporary music in there.
And also worth saying that, you know, it's very careful study of the Bible. What they've done is, like, they've taken stuff that's very faithful to the Bible. There's nothing at all blasphemous in this. Like, you could go in as a believer and you could probably enjoy the film. I found there's, like, a few things, like, for example, there's this fantasy season where they're sequence where they're smoking opium and then they start floating and things. And there's a few things like that just kind of clanged for me that didn't quite come together. And there's also a lot of whimsy, and I think that's a little bit overdone, but at the same time, like, it's a really entertaining thing, and it's really original, and it's worth watching for Benedict Cumberbatch alone, who turns up. He's this tramp on the streets of Jerusalem, and he's just absolutely covered in dirt. And then when he gets Jesus gives him the power to multiply coins, the real Jesus, and then he turns out to look exactly like Jesus once you get onto the dirt.
It's a makeover. So
that, it does sound like a bit of fun. Is it worth going to? And stars on this one, Tara?
3.5 for me.
Good solid 3.5. What about you, Hilary? Where are you with it?
It's 4 for me. I really liked it, and I liked the strange sensibility about it all. Great soundtrack too.
You both had a good time at that one, it sounds. Let's move on then to our final film this evening, The Sweetest East, a film which impressed at Cannes last year, being described as a picaresque journey and a savage satire on modern America. We're following teen Lillian's episodic journey around the eastern United States as she encounters a potpourri of characters played by stars including Jacob Elordi and honorary Irish woman Ayo Edebiri, she of The Bear and Beyond at this stage. A big hit at Cannes last year. Lillian, the character of Lillian, played by Talia Ryder.
Yes.
Kept wondering, is she any relation to Winona Ryder? But one's a Y and one's an I, isn't she?
Yes. So it's
no relationship.
Definitely not the same thing at all. It belongs to sort of a classic strain of American literature, I suppose, like Little Big Man and stuff, where it's this and then kind of story. But it's a real rollicking kind of story, and she just kind of bounces through it all, and it becomes as well. It's very much rooted in American politics and how hilariously bipolar American politics are, and it has a good bit of fun with that. So the opening scene of the movie is Talia at Lillian is on a high school trip to Washington, and if you remember Pizzagate a few years ago, the famous story of the guy who walked into the pizza thing because he figured out online that there was some kind of pedophile ring somehow connected to Hillary Clinton, and there wasn't, but in this story it imagines that there is a real ring underneath the ground, and from there then she bounces into kind of into an anarchist kind of network, and then she bounces into this neo-Nazi network, and there she meets this kind of weird soulful neo-Nazi played by Simon Rex, who you might remember from Red Rocket or MTV in the 90s if you're old enough to remember that, but he loves Edgar Allan Poe, but he also has a swastika bedspread, so.
Gentlemanly Nazi,
And I guess it is a picaresque, as we say. So she's journeying around. She gets, I suppose, these are pretty discreet scenes, and the characters she meets, they're there for a while and then they're gone. So a lot of this is on Talia Ryder as Lillian. She has to carry it to a large extent, Hilary.
Yeah, and I think she's a very interesting character because, you know, in this very, you know, madcap America, which is. It's strange enough to give this film a slightly surrealist tone in places, and yet grounded in a very real and recognisable America. She is she's the most still thing in the entire film. She's moving through it. She's kind of passing through this very strange America with these threats around the corner. And she's a bit of an operator herself. She's learned to navigate by her looks and her wiles. And, you know, she does strange things that in any other movie would be disastrous, like get into a car with a man she's just met and that kind of thing. But it doesn't go down that route because it has a kind of naivety, this film, which is quite charming in a way, yeah. I would say.
Yeah. All right, let's listen to Lillian then, played by Talia Ryder. Here she is auditioning for an enthusiastic, rather self-absorbed, it will have to be said, two filmmakers, Molly and Matthew, played by the aforementioned Ayo Edebiri and Jeremy O'Harris.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be able to do it. If you wanted me, I mean.
Oh. We want you.
Yeah, we do.
We wouldn't have went through this whole rigmarole if it wasn't about you.
I'm between spaces right now, and it's just trying to balance a lot of things.
Okay, so are you looking for a space here in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
Oh my God, so this is insane. My aunt is in Istanbul for a month, and she gave me her keys to take care of her plants, and she has a full townhouse in Sugar Hill, just empty, waiting for someone to water the plants. I don't like watering plants. Plants freak me out. That will be your only responsibility in this house. But then you would have a place to stay here in New York, living a Carrie Bradshaw dream and also starring in a film.
If I'm you, it's yes.
I mean, yeah, I'm down.
Wow.
Yeah. This is amazing.
Okay, wait, do we have...
Yeah, should we do the other side? Oh, wait, I don't have your number.
Oh, I don't have a cell phone.
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
Wow.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is amazing that she doesn't have a cell phone. Jeremy O'Harris, Naya Adebiri there, and of course Talia Ryder as Lillian in a scene from The Sweet East. I was saying as we were listening to that, if Swift were alive, if Jonathan Dean Swift were alive today, this is the type of screenplay he'd be writing.
Yeah, it's so clever, and it covers so many bases as it goes along, not just politically, but it has so many great characters.
And does it whack at both sides of the red and the blue?
It's a plague on all houses, not just both. It's a plague on everybody. And it has really great fun doing that. There's absolutely no mass. As Hilary was saying, that idea that she can get into a car and nothing happens to her. It's almost like a Studio Ghibli film, My Neighbor Totoro or something, where you can get into the cat bus and it doesn't matter. And she lives this charmed life. Yeah. And it's absolutely, it's fabulous. It's a great film.
I think this is the most fun of the four films that you saw this week, Hilary.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the look of it as well. I mean, Sean Price Williams, he's a cinematographer. This is actually his directorial debut.
Yeah.
And he's probably best known for his films with Alex Ross Perry, a very funny and inventive indie director in the States, of films like Listen Up, Philip. So it has this kind of sort of grainy, almost kind of 90s look about it. You'd expect her to wander into a Sonic Youth gig at any moment, but it's still this world where they can't believe she doesn't have a phone. So it's very much now.
Yeah.
I really liked it. 4 stars.
4 for you. And it sounds as if you had a similarly good time at the cinema.
Yeah, I'd go 5. I think it's a great film.
The full 5 on it. Okay. That's it. The Sweet East. So Hilary White and Tara Brady are two reviewers this evening. Abigail, All You Need Is Death, The Book of Clarence and The Sweet East, all open in cinemas this weekend. Patricia Kelly's first feature film, Verdigris, is the story of two women who become friends despite their vastly different backgrounds. They begin to discover they have more in common than they would like perhaps to admit. The film will be screened at the Lime Tree Theatre, the Bell Table in Limerick, this Saturday evening as part of the Catalyst Film Festival. Patricia wrote, directed and produced Verdigris, launched it at last year's Galway Film Flat, where it won Best Independent Film, swiftly followed by winning Best Irish Film at the Kerry International Film Festival and Best Feature at the Irish Film Festival in London. It has also been nominated for 5 IFTAs, including Best Film, Best Script, Best Director, all 3 for Patricia, and IFTA nominations for the 2 lead actors, Geraldine McAlinden as Marion and Maya O'Shea as Jewel. Good night and thank you very much, Patricia Kelly. It sounds as if there is nothing more I need to ask you. I mean, it has been a phenomenal success so far for you.
It has. We're so delighted and grateful and astonished with how people are responding to Verdigris. It's really gratifying. You know, a very small amount of us put a lot of work into it. It was made with very few resources. I actually only just today looked over the end credits and counted up the cast and crew, and it's a sum total of 40 people.
Wow! Which and is, you shot it over 15 days.
We did. We shot it over 15. 15 days, three five-day weeks in January and February last year. We only finished shooting on the 3rd of February, and then it was a whirlwind to get it ready for the Galway Film Fla. And 6 months to the day that we started shooting, we won our first award. So it's been great.
That's quite quick. Yeah, in fact, you were saying about, you know, how you made it on with very little resources. There's one point when the character of the Mayo Shea character, the young woman in this, we'll get to who the two characters, but the young woman, Jewel, is standing waiting on a bus to come, and the 1-2-3 bus comes up along, and I thought, I'd say that was just the bus that came along on the day. It didn't feel as if it was, you know, whatever bus comes, that's the one we're using for the
shoot.
That was
it. That was it. Yeah.
And that's not to belittle the film in any way, because it was perfectly shot. We got all the angles we needed on that bus coming up to the bus stop. Now, so the centre in not in many ways, the centre of this film is the relationship that builds between Geraldine McAlinden's Marion and Marianne and Myla O'Shea's Jewel. Two very different women, two very different backgrounds, different ages. Everything that could be different between the two of them is different. Tell us, first of all, about the Geraldine McAlinden character and where she's at.
Yeah, so I Marion's character was the one I came up with first. I really wanted to have a look at the expectations that we might have about a middle-aged, middle-class woman, recently retired, living in a leafy suburb in Dublin, and to look at that a little bit further. Somebody that I know was in a coercively controlling relationship for decades, and I wanted to look at that and explore what was going on there with the character of Marion. And the reason that that came to me was a few years ago, I was working in the day job, and a representative from Women's Aid came in to talk to us.
The day job being?
A legal secretary. And a representative of Women's Aid came in to talk to us, and made the point that a lot of people think that domestic violence is a working class issue and a working class problem. It's an idea that that's out there, and it's very much not the case. It very much spans all social classes, etc.
And all ages, as
exactly,
well.
Very much so. So that's what I really wanted to explore with Marion's character. So she arrived, you know, relatively fully formed for me as a character when
let's have a listen to the type of, because it really struck me how, I'm going to use the word gentle, it's not, gentle isn't the right word, but how inobtrusive in many ways this type of coercive control is. But once you start to notice it, you notice that everything is controlled.
Exactly.
So here's a discussion between Marianne, played by Geraldine McAlinden, and her husband, Nigel, played by Michael James Ford. And they're just having a gentle conversation about possibly where they might go, any chance that we might go on holidays somewhere different this year.
Is there anywhere special you'd like to go?
You don't want to go back to the Algarve with Anya and Sean?
Of course. But maybe we could take a second trip. Somewhere further away.
Like deep sea diving. You don't seem to be able to remember that we've only got one salary now.
But that's why I thought a second part-time job would be...
Where? You've only ever worked in the one law firm your entire life.
You've only ever worked in one accounting. Maybe a local small solicitor could use a per hands a couple hours a week.
You've spent too many years around solicitors. That's your problem.
That's Michael James Ford there as Nigel, Geraldine McAlinden as Marianne. And as I say, it's just a slow peeling away of the woman's self-esteem. He belittles her job. He belittles every choice she makes. She's trying desperately hard to make this relationship work, and he just doesn't want to know.
Very much so. And he has taken over the entire house with his hobby, so that
his little toy soldiers exactly. And he does battles, pretend battles with the soldiers.
Yes, and her space, her physical space over the years and over the decades just shrank to almost nothing in her own home. And we see him doing a number of, you know, smaller things that you might think, oh, there's nothing in that.
Yeah.
But it's when they all build up, you realise this
The accumulation is what becomes more and more and more and more difficult as the film progresses. And she touches on it there in that clip that we heard. She touches on this idea that she might get a little part-time job for herself. She's retired at this stage, but she wants to get out of the house. She wants to talk to people.
And a little financial freedom as well.
Yeah, a little bit of her own money to be coming in. So she becomes a census enumerator and chooses to go to an area that nobody else would dare take on board as a census enumerator. Mm-hmm. An interesting choice to give. Was that just simply a way of getting her out of her own milieu in this middle class area?
It was. And also, actually, the idea for that is that in 2016, I was a census enumerator in Dublin's North Inner City. That's where that idea came from. And it was a hugely interesting experience. And at the time, I thought, OK, as writers do, I stored it away in my brain and thought I'll come back to this at some point. So when I was looking to write something that was very pared back, very minimalistic, I thought that's it. There's a great opportunity now to come back to this, an interesting location, opportunity to meet lots of fun characters and to throw somebody in there that would be very daunted by the prospect.
Yeah.
And then I could bring in this
And of
character.
Course, I mean, going to people with a census form saying, I want to know everything about you.
Yeah.
But she was going to get a lot of grief at the various doors that she goes to, for sure. But the real heart of the film for me was this relationship that builds, as I say, between the character of Jewel, played by Milo O'Shea, and that character of Marianne, played by Geraldine McAleen. The Jewel character, and indeed Milo O'Shea herself, this is an extraordinary. Is this a debut, a first performance, or a very early performance?
Yes, it is a very early. She's only, I think, a couple of years out of acting school, and she's a hell of a find. She's just magic. I honestly think that Maya is going to have an amazing career ahead of her.
When she walked in the door to audition, I presume you just went, yes, we now have our Jewel.
Well, that's it. Actually, the audition process started with the self taping, and so I received a great many self tapes sent over to me, and I had a lovely short list of excellent young actors. But yet, straight away, the minute I started watching Maya's self tape, was like, ooh, this is good.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other aspect of this is the name Jewel tells us something, because we're going to make, maybe I'm speaking for myself, but I think a lot of people watching will make automatic presumptions about, all right, so the middle class woman comes into the inner city area and meets this young woman. To say down on her luck is kind of misleading, but who certainly is in a difficult situation. We put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. You know, she's a minor living alone in a social housing flat complex, and everything doesn't seem to be above board. And Marion quickly twigs this and asks for her help when Marion is not getting a whole lot of success at the doors. She thinks if
I have somebody with knowledge of this particular area, we'll have some hope. Here's the moment where Maya O'Shea then as Jewel and Marianne as Catherine McAlinden, this is when they meet in the film.
Jewel, participation in the 2022 census is mandatory, not voluntary. It means you have to do it.
I know what mandatory means and voluntary. I've heard you, giving your speech all around the building. Everywhere I go, there you are, wobbling your lardy arse.
Well, you get a parent or a guardian to fill out this form properly, and you won't ever have to see my lordy arse again.
Yeah. There we go. So that's Maya O'Shea as Jewel and Geraldine McAlinden as Marianne in a scene from Verdigris. Patricia Kelly, the writer, director, producer, Jenner Dog's Body, I think, on the film, is with me in studio this evening. And I was asking, you were saying that you had been a census enumerator yourself, and I wondered, how'd you come across a character like Jewel? And it's a kind of an amalgamation, you were saying.
An amalgamation of a few characters. You know, in fairness, lots of people, you know, were very happy to be part of the process. process. And but of course, there are a lot of people who didn't welcome giving their information to a person at the door and putting it on a form and so on. So there, you know, there you that's part of the training that you go through to try and
to
bring people around.
But
yes.
What I mean, Jewel is such a wonderful name for this character because, as I say, we're going to make loads of presumptions about her, but there's such wonderful inner strength in this character, resourcefulness. Now, she has to do lots of unsavory things to be resourceful, but she knows how to survive.
Very much so. She has been surviving since she was 12, and she's intelligent, and you know, she's also has a strong empathy for people, but she has built up a little bit of a hard shell to protect herself. But it was definitely something that I wanted to explore here, that she's not what you're going to automatically think that she is as a character, and we get to know her, and we see that she in a lot of ways she's a lot wiser than the older woman.
You also, it's interesting, you were talking earlier on about the woman speaking to somebody from Women's Aid. She gets involved in the sex industry to basically to make money, to help herself, look after herself. How did you go about researching that particular aspect of the film?
It was a mix of a number of things. I spoke to some current and previous sex workers, listened to a lot of podcasts, I read some books. I tried to come at it from a number of different angles, and very much so, it was very important to me not to be coming at it in any way from a judgmental perspective. Any way that you look at it, it's not my story in that kind of way. It's not my history to tell. So I really wanted to try to give voice to the character.
I thought it was interesting too, and I do want to keep the concentration of the interview on those two women and particularly on that Jewel character. But it's interesting the men that you bring in and around Jewel's circle. Not the worst people in the world, it has to be said.
Well, exactly. It was really important that none of the men in the film, and especially also Marion's husband, Nigel, none of them are, you know, arch villains, you know, cartoon characters. It was important very much to show humanity, that everybody is a flawed individual. Some more so than others, but absolutely, there would be no point to depict Jewel's clients or Marion's husband as just being 100% bad or evil. That's not reality.
Yeah. But it is really about these two women. What coming to the, and I don't want you to give away anything about how it finishes up.
Yeah.
But coming to this, the marriage of these two very different minds, was that there for you from the very beginning, or was it something that just had to come out as the script was written?
Yeah, no, it was when I was sketching out the script and the plot and the characters before I even started writing it. I knew that it was going to be all about their relationship and how they were going to change each other's lives. And I knew that they were going to, on the face of it, be kind of polar opposites. So in that kind of way, it was a lot of fun, really, to come up with their developing friendship and relationship. And so that was probably one of the easier parts of writing it.
And I suppose they are both marginalised people in their own respect, and that fits into the whole idea of Catalyst. However, it's screening at Catalyst on Saturday evening, or Saturday afternoon, isn't it?
Saturday evening.
Yeah. But you're going to have to come flying back up the road for the IFTAs.
That's right. Now we're heading down to Catalyst tomorrow morning for the day. There's a full day, an industry day of screenwriting, and Catalyst is a fantastic film festival. They really, you know, champion diversity and inclusion, and they're trying this year to focus on underrepresented voices coming in from the script writing stage. So there's a number of panels and training things going on. And myself and co-producer Paul Fitzsimons and Geraldine McLinden are going to be part of a panel tomorrow. So that'll be exciting. But yes, then we have to come back up quickly on Saturday night for the IFTAs.
Well, every best wish for the IFTAs. And people can find out what Verdigris is and means when they go and see the film. There's a small explanation. Or it links into a particular plot point that I don't want to go into. Verdigris will be screened at the Bell Table in Limerick this Saturday night, 8 p.m. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Producers, as Patricia, as she was telling us, and Paul Fitzsimon, along with Geraldine McLinden, will take part in an event from script to screen, the low stroke, no budget way of doing it. And that'll be moderated by Hannah Quinn. Full details on Catalyst International Film Festival.com. Now, while Martin McDonagh's film work has been winning acclaim in Hollywood, his theatre work is in a busy state of revival. The most recent is the production of The Pillow Man by Belfast Lyric Theatre and Prime Cut Productions, who had a very successful run with McDonagh's most popular play, The Beauty Queen of Lynan, in the summer of 2023. The Pillow Man is a macabre portrait of a writer whose nightmarish stories come disturbingly true against the backdrop of a totalitarian regime. Arrested then, the writer is interrogated by two detectives because some of his stories resemble a spate of child murders. The play is directed by Prime Cut's Emma Jordan, stars Abigail McGibbon as Topolsky, one of the interrogating detectives. And delighted to be joined from Belfast this evening by both Emma and Abigail. It seems, Emma, that you have caught the McDonagh bug, the Martin McDonagh bug. What drew you to The Pillow Man?
I've wanted to direct The Pillow Man for a good 15 years. When it was first produced, in 2003 at the National, and I never saw that production, but I read so much about it. And over the ensuing years, as a company, we tried to get the rights for many times, but the rights weren't available for a long period, really, until Decadent Theatre Company did their great production.
Yes,
it was 2015, so that's nearly 9 years ago. So I thought there was a good enough space between Decadent's production, which toured a lot, and I know that many people have spoken about, you know, that how wonderful that theatre experience was, but timely for us to come back, and we're in a bit sailing with a good wind behind us. I think Beauty Queen was a great success. It was great fun to do. It won the UK Theatre Award, and you know, so we thought, right, on the back of that, let's try a McDonagh.
And it's a very, in some ways it's an incredibly different world from the kind of, you can't talk about rural idyll, but the rural nastiness, I suppose, of a McDonagh play.
Absolutely.
And particularly Beauty Queen. This is a totalitarian state, and these unusual names, Topolsky, Kachurian,
yes,
you know, there's definitely an Eastern European feel to it.
Absolutely.
How do you describe what it is, Emma?
Really, in terms of making decisions about where somewhere is set, we haven't been absolutely specific that it is in this place, and a bit like McDonagh doesn't present it that way. But I think that the setting it in a totalitarian state per se really allows McDonagh to open up all his questions about what it is to be an artist, the responsibility of a writer in a state where any story as allegory could be seen as incendiary, where artists are usually, you know, one of the first in the firing line whenever they want to kind of clear out a society. They'll get anybody who has an opinion or any creativity, and they'll be the first to go. So, you know, it's an interesting frame, I think, for him then to examine the nature of storytelling.
Does Northern Ireland present any particular relevance or any particular parallels to that type of state?
I mean, to be honest with you, Sean, you look around the world. I mean, I don't think any of us are too far away at the moment of thinking about what does a totalitarian state look like, and you know how the serious mess the world is in at the moment. So, you know, I think that you can, as a member of the audience, you can take that on your own terms.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many themes within the play that really, you know, whatever rings your bell in terms of what's your takeaway here with this play, you know, it's extraordinary.
Now, I'm going to be accused of being a Blue Lights fanatic at this point in time as I come to Abigail McGibbon. Abigail, people will know you. I admitted last night that I'm watching both season one and two in tandem at the moment. I refuse to do one and then two. I'm doing a kind of an episode from each. And of course, you were the character of Tina from season one from Blue Lights.
Yeah.
What can you carry from that very realistic Northern Irish experience into a Topolsky here, where you're on the other side of the divide, because you're quite definitely on the illegal side of the divide in Blue Lights? What do you carry when you're playing this detective, Topolsky?
I suppose There's, you know, there consequences very questionable for both of those characters. You know, for Topolsky, because she's on the side of the state, on the side of the dictatorship, and also for Tina in Blue Lights. You know, well, when the consequences do come, they will be vast, I imagine. But while everything's going okay for them, you know, and when there are no consequences, it's that life's just that bit easier, isn't it?
Yeah,
you can say that bit more, you can push more buttons, you can...
Is Topolsky the good cop or the bad cop in the interrogation process?
Well, Ariel, the other cop, says he's the more apparently physically violent one at the beginning of the play, and then he says to Couturian, the prisoner, oh, by the way, I'm the good cop, she's the bad cop. So it's all to play for.
Yeah, it is. It is all to play for. Now, and the he's and the she's are mixed up nicely. There is McDonagh prescriptive in terms of the gender of the writer or indeed the detectives in this case, Emma?
Well, in fairness, the characters are written in the male gender, Topolsky, Ariel, Couturian. But, you know, as you kind of see in the, you know, the recent production in the West End with Lily Allen.
Yeah.
I think
she played the writer, didn't she?
She did.
Couturian,
she, yeah. She played Couturian and kind of went up the play, and kind of what I envisaged that would work well was is given this changing the gender of the Topolsky character. And I have to say that there's great fun in that, and we're having great fun of that, because you kind of have a very smart, a more mature, more experienced kind of character pitched against the other cop, who uses, let's say, their brawn more than their brain to get the results. So we're probably having a bit of gender fun in that regard, in terms of mixing it about. And in fairness, you know, Martin is still very much in control of his work, and in terms of saying yes, no, or maybe. Yeah, so obviously he feels comfortable enough with these kind of pushing these.
I think this is the first McDonagh play that you've acted in, Abigail, but you have done a few David Ireland plays along the way, Everything Between Us, about the sisters who disagree over the Good Friday Agreement, and the title role in Sadie. There were others there as well. Mm-hmm. It struck me that McDonagh's and Ireland's world, they're not that dissimilar theatrically.
Yes, they're not. And David would, you know, be a fan of McDonagh. And I know McDonagh went to see... Ulster American, David Heard. He snipped in. And David makes me laugh. He always says he panics if there's not, regardless of what's happening on stage, how awful it is, he panics if there's not a laugh about every page and a half. And you can sort of
not dissimilar.
Smell that a bit from McDonagh as well. But it's he just has a shocking talent for expression, be it humour or frankness, or you know, it's breathtaking and funny with Emma talking about the gender shift, because I asked her when I was offered, going, why do you want him to be a female, and she went, I just see no reason why he shouldn't. Which is just perfect. It's the perfect answer.
I must admit, when I kind of heard that it was you that was playing, I thought, yeah, it kind of makes sense in some ways just to make that shift. But you also went to, I believe you got some tips from a former RUC officer regarding how to approach Topolsky.
I did. He was very, very generous with his time. He's the only one that I've spoken to, because... even to begin with, I even found it hard to get into the shoes of a cop. Because, you know, if the job is offered you, everything that comes with that, the power, everything that comes with it, it was just odd to me. But once I'd spoken to him, I felt much better.
What particular things did he say that made you feel so good?
Well, that it's your job, and that everything that, like I was saying, there must be, because with Topolsky,
I kind of feel that she loves, she enjoys the interrogation, the interview. She enjoys the back and forth. And I said, is that, am I wrong? And he said, oh, no. There are plenty of cops that love that. And feeling of, you know, glee and smugness, yeah, and everything, you know, if you get a clean confession. So it just became sort of normal, like anybody else's job.
There you go.
You know, I had just been putting it elsewhere and non-understandable. But then, regardless of that, then you just have to go back to McDonough's writing. Yeah, it's use all the words. There.
Well, I don't want to be interrogated by you or Carsey. I can tell you that for nothing. Thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. Abigail McGibbon and Emma Jordan. And the Pillow Man, Martin McDonough's play, is at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast from the 16th of May through until the 15th of June. For the details on lyrictheatre.co.uk. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1.